Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. The fiqh of marriage, the rulings on the woman in her mourning and what she is prohibited from doing. Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen, Salatu wassalam ala Rasulihim Kareem wa alihi wa sahbihi wa sallam. Allahumma alimna ma yanfa'una wa anfa'na Rabbana bima alamtana wa zidna ilma. أسأل الله تعالى أن يوفقنا لما يحب ويرضى اللهم صل على نبينا محمد وآله وصحبه وسلم أما بعد respected brothers in Islam السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته I'd like to welcome you inshallah for today's lesson which is continuing in the commentary of our noble ulama in the book Bulugh al-Maram, Attainment of the Objective by the great scholar Ibn Hajar al-Asqalani. And the commentary here is from Masjid al-Nabawi al-Sharif. In the classes they were held in the Masjid of the Prophet and the teacher, his name was Sheikh Atiyah Muhammad Salim. He commented on these traditions or these ahadith based on his ulama going all the way back to the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. So inshallah ta'ala we'll continue on that path of knowledge and we ask Allah to use us to convey this ilm and let it propagate until the day of judgment. Ameen. So alhamdulillah, respected brothers in Islam, last time we were speaking about a hadith of a woman who came to the Prophet ﷺ and she was asking about the maintenance or the spending on her when her husband had divorced her. Her husband was from, or had traveled to Yemen actually, and he had written her a letter. This woman, her name is Fatima binti Qais. So her husband had traveled to Yemen and then wrote her a letter saying in the letter that he had divorced her for the third time. So from this hadith, the woman, when she received this letter, she went to the Prophet ﷺ and she wanted to ask about her right for being spent on by her husband. Does she have a right or not? And because her husband had only given a small amount of dates for her to live on during her iddah, her waiting period after divorce. So we discussed the different views of the scholars on that issue, and there is a difference of opinion amongst the four madhahib. Some of the imams, they say that the woman who's permanently divorced, she deserves spending and housing during her waiting period, like Abu Hanifa. Some of them, they said that she doesn't deserve any spending or nor any housing. And this is the majority view. And also from this text, what we found is that the husband, since he can no longer take her back, then she's permanently divorced, then the ulama say that the majority view is that the woman who is permanently divorced for the third time, she doesn't get any housing or spending money. But if she's been divorced, a temporary divorce, which means that he divorces her one time or two times, and he can still take her back, then does the husband have to spend on her? If a person, he divorces his wife once or twice, and she's still in the waiting period, she stays in his house, right? She's not allowed to leave the house. Are you familiar with this? A man, when he divorces his wife, he says, "Anti tariq, you are divorced." Can she leave his house at that moment, as soon as he says it? Or does she have to remain in the house for some time? Remain in the house. For how long?
4 months.
4 months and 10 days is if her husband died. She has to stay in her husband's house for 4 months and 10 days. But if the husband divorced her once or twice, she has to stay in his house for three menstrual cycles. So during that time, when she's in his house and waiting to see if maybe they can reconcile, maybe he'll change his mind, he might take her back, maybe she will change her way of dealing with him to make him take her back, he has to spend on her. He has to let her live in the house. He cannot kick her out of the house. And he cannot cut her off from the spending. So this is what we had covered in the previous hadith. A couple other things we learned from that hadith is it allowed for a man to divorce his wife by a letter or by writing? No? Can a man write a letter to his wife and say, I divorce you? What happened in this hadith? Her husband went to Yemen, right? And then he wrote a letter to her saying, I divorce you. Counted, right? So it's allowed to do that. It is allowed to do that. But it has to be, the ulama say, if it's written divorce, you have to make sure he intended it. You know, somebody might have been typing something on his phone as a joke, and then he hit send by accident to his wife, you're divorced. So she reads it, so the ulama, they say that the written divorce, it has to be, you have to check to make sure he did it, he intended that. Because he might have divorced her by accident. He might have hit the email, he was just joking around, and he hit send to his wife. So it has to be with intention. That's one of the things we learn from this hadith. Also one of the things we learned from the hadith, and this is very interesting point, is that the woman who narrated this hadith, there's no other men who narrated this hadith, only a woman narrated it. And that shows you that we can accept the hadith of women. Even if there's no men, other men who narrated the narration. Now, for example, Aisha, are you familiar? She narrated many hadith. Are we told that we have to find another woman? Does it have to be two women that narrated hadith, like witnessing in a court? One woman is sufficient. And many of the wives of the Prophet ﷺ, they narrate hadith, and they don't have any other women narrating the same hadith. So even one woman, she can narrate a hadith, and we have to act on that hadith. Now, and this shows you that narrating of the hadith is different than witnessing in a court. You know, when there's a court case and a woman, when there's a financial dispute and the witnesses are being called, what does Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala say? There should be two male witnesses. If there's not two male witnesses, then one male witness and two female witnesses. So in the court, the woman, her testimony it has to be two women so they can remind each other, as the ayah says. If one of them forgets, then the other woman will remind her. And that's only in financial transactions. In the hudud, like the punishments, can a woman be a witness? Like say zina, for example, need four eyewitnesses, right? Who saw the zina? Can you have four male eyewitnesses? Can you have three male eyewitnesses and two females? No. And all the other punishments or all the other court cases, only male witnesses are accepted when it comes to punishment. But narrating hadith is different. Narrating hadith is different than witnessing in a court. This is a good or a very important issue. Why is it that women cannot witness against a person in the hudud, like the zina? Her witness is not accepted. But when it comes to narrating hadith, and that hadith might go from that woman to millions of people, we accept the woman's narration. Why is that? And here, this, when we understand this, we realize that the reason for this is not because women are not allowed to convey knowledge. In fact, women are allowed to convey knowledge. That's why we accept all the hadith from the female sahabiyat. They conveyed us many, many of the hadith. But the reason that the woman is normally does not testify in the court against other people in matters that are not related to women is because testimony in a court is like a type of authority, where this is how the ulama, they explain it, is that in the court, there's, when the woman is testifying, she's like testifying against somebody, right? When she's a witness, she's testifying against one person and in favor of another person, and she's putting herself in that position of authority. So there's the different parties are involved. So the woman is responsible over those parties. Her witnessing in the court in that case would be like a type of authority against one party and in favor of the other party. And so here the ulama, they say that the woman, she doesn't normally take on this type of authority. The average woman, the common woman on the street, she's not called to, or she's not encouraged to be in that position of authority. Whereas conveying the knowledge, the woman is encouraged to convey the knowledge, because if she's in the court, she is an authority to, her witnessing could be the cause of the punishment of one person and the freedom of another person. If she were to be a witness, that would be, she would be responsible for that. And a woman cannot have authority over a man, normally speaking, right? If somebody's getting married and a woman wants to get married, can she wed herself? Can she give herself away in marriage? Usually in Islamic law, the majority of the madhab, they say that the woman has to have a guardian over herself. She cannot be guardian to herself, and a woman cannot be guardian over another woman, right? Can a girl bring her mom and say, my mom is going to wed me and give me away in marriage? No, she has to be a man, right? So a woman cannot be a guardian over another woman. So can a woman be a guardian over a man? Even less, right? Even less likely for that to be allowed. By being a witness in the court in favor of a man or against a man, it's as if she's having a type of guardianship over that person who she's witnessing for. You see that? So that's why it's not really allowed for her to do that, because she would be like an authority over a man, and in Islam, the woman, she doesn't have authority over other people, other men. But when it comes to conveying the knowledge, then the even one woman, she narrates a hadith, say Aisha narrated a hadith, then this is, does she have authority over any other individual? Is she putting herself in authority over another person? No. She's just she's just conveying the knowledge that she learned. And then that person will take that knowledge and spread it to other people, and so on and so on. So the Prophet ﷺ, he allowed one person to witness the moon, for example, in Ramadan. So one person, he saw the moon, like Ibn Umar, and he accepted that narration, and then it spread to the rest of society. Even though millions of people might be affected by that witnessing, even one person sees the moon, then everybody else, they follow that shahada, that testimony, that khabar. just conveying some knowledge. So conveying knowledge is accepted from anybody, even a kafir. If he conveys you some knowledge, or a slave, if he conveys some knowledge, we can accept it, especially if the kafir, he became Muslim, but he says, I saw something before when I was a kafir, and he conveys that knowledge, we accept it. And a slave, if he conveys some knowledge, we accept that. A slave who conveys, like Bilal radiallahu anhu, when he conveys us some knowledge, some ahadith, we accept that. Or any of the other people who are slaves, we accept that knowledge. However, in a court, can a slave bear witness against a free person? No, they don't have that authority. Can a disbelieving person have the authority over a Muslim? Like, can, for example, a woman is a Muslim, her father is kafir. Can her father have authority over her in marriage? No. The Prophet ﷺ said, no kafir can have guardianship over a Muslim. So these are some of the differences between conveying the knowledge, conveying the hadith, and testifying in court. So a woman, can she convey the hadith? Can she narrate hadith? Is it allowed? Yes, it's absolutely allowed. But can she witness against a man, for example? Can a woman be a witness in a court against a man? No. Because it's a type of authority, a guardianship. Because she's going to testify, what she says could cause that man to go to jail or be punished or executed. So that type of authority or guardianship is not normally given to a woman over a man, normally speaking. Okay, so this is some of the differences between the court and between the narration of hadith. And so many times the women, they reminded Umar ibn al-Khattab even of some things he had forgotten. When Umar, when he said that women could not inherit, could not get the dowry of more than the portion that the wives of the Prophet ﷺ got, a woman stood up and said, "Oh Umar, the Quran, it says that a woman, if she got a treasure of dowry, do not take it back from her. If you gave a woman a qintar, a huge treasure of dowry, do not take it back from her." So the woman actually reminded Umar ibn al-Khattab. She was conveying the knowledge. She didn't have the authority over him, but she was expressing the knowledge to him. So this was allowed to do that. Okay. So this is basically what we learned from the hadith from last time. Also, we learned that when the Prophet ﷺ, he told Fatima, she felt lonely in her house when her husband had divorced her, he allowed her to go to the house of Abdullah ibn Ummi Maktum, the Sahabi who was blind. She allowed him to stay in his house. And he said, "You can change your clothes and you wouldn't feel uncomfortable because he doesn't see." So we learn from this two things. One, that a woman, if she feels unsafe in her husband's home, if she's doing her waiting period, she's allowed to go to another home where she feels safe. She's allowed to leave that home. If she's in her waiting period after being permanently divorced. Also, we learn that a woman, she's allowed to look at a man. Men, they're not allowed to look at a woman, normally speaking. But a woman, she entered the house of Abdullah ibn Ummi Maktum. She's going to see him. She's going to look at him. But the Prophet ﷺ did not find any harm in that. The harm was if he was looking at her. But he didn't say that if you go there, you're going to see him. You shouldn't go there. He let her go to that house. So this shows also that a woman can look at a strange man. Inshallah ta'ala. Okay, so let's go together, inshallah, to the next hadith, bi'idhnillahi ta'ala. And this is a very interesting hadith. May Allah give us the understanding of it, which is, what can a woman do who's a widow during her mourning period? You know, say a woman, her husband passed away. She has a mourning period, and what is she allowed to do, or what is she prevented from doing during that mourning period? Inshallah, in this hadith will cover some of those rulings, inshallah ta'ala. So in this hadith, it was narrated by Umm Atiyah, may Allah be pleased with her, that the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, let not a woman have a mourning period over a dead person more than 3 days. More than 3 days, except for her husband, 4 months and 10 days. 4 months and 10 days. And let her not wear a colored dress. Let her not wear a colored dress, nor except a woolen type garment. And let her not wear the kuhul, the eye makeup, antimony. And let her not wear the perfume, the tlib, except after purifying herself from her menses, a small amount. This hadith is agreed upon. And the narration is from Muslim. And in some narrations of Abu Dawood, it says, and let her not comb her hair. Let her not wear the henna. Excuse me. Abu Dawood says, let her not wear the henna. And Nasa'i says, and combing her hair. Okay, so let us go over this hadith, inshallah. This narration is by Umm Atiyah, and she said that the Prophet ﷺ, he said, we'll go a little bit at a time, he said that let not a woman have the mourning for more than 3 days. Everybody know what mourning is, the mourning period? In Arabic, they call this the ihdad, the mourning period. And it's a time when the woman, she does not go out of her husband's home after he passed away, if it's for the husband. And she also doesn't beautify herself and expose herself to marriage offers during that time. There's this period of 4 months and 10 days is a period where the woman is preventing herself from beautifying in order to attract people to marry her, or for allowing other people to come and propose to her. So the Shaykh here, he mentions that the wording for the mourning period, the ihdad, it comes from the word had. And had in Arabic, it means to prevent something. To prevent something. This is where we get the word hudud in Arabic. We've often heard this word, hudud. Hudud in Arabic, it literally means the things, the preventing. And the reason for that is that these penalties or these punishments, when they are applied, they prevent, they cause a deterrence to the society. And it prevents the society from doing those crimes. When the hudud are applied, hudud means limits or preventatives. When they're applied, then it deters the rest of society from doing the crime that would cause that punishment. So this is like, for example, stealing. When the hud of stealing is applied, then it prevents other people from doing the stealing, and so on. So here, the mourning period is called ihdad, or the the waiting period for the woman. And this is because it prevents the woman whose husband has died from remarrying during that time. And this applies to all women, whether they're young or old, Muslim or non-Muslim, even free or slave, as long as there's a marriage contract, even if they did not consummate the marriage, even if they didn't have relations, she still has to do the waiting period. Any wife, it is the right of any wife that had a marriage contract with her husband, then she has to do the waiting period, the mourning. Any wife who had the right for time with her husband, she has to do the waiting period for her husband. As for a zaniya, astaghfirullah, somebody who did zina, or you know, a slave woman who was the mother of a child of her master, there's no iddah in these cases. There's no waiting period. Okay. What about a woman who her husband pronounced a divorce on her? He said he gave one divorce to his wife, but she's still in the she's still within her waiting period. She didn't finish the 3 months yet, so she's still living with him. Say during that time her husband dies. He divorced her once, he didn't make it final yet because it's not 3 months, but during that time when she's waiting for the three menstrual cycles, her husband dies. Does she have to mourn for him? Does she have to do the mourning period? Anybody want to guess or take a...
Yes, she still has to wait 4 months.
Yeah. That's right. Why does she have to do that?
Because of pregnancy.
Because of pregnancy. The 3 months, three menstrual cycles, if she has the menstruations, she knows that she's not pregnant. Does she to finish after 3 months, or does it? She have to wait the 4 months and 10 days?
She still has to wait the 4 months.
That's right. That's right. Because she's still considered like a wife. Because it's not a permanent divorce. That when he said he pronounced one divorce, she's in like a hanging state. Either he might take her back, or if the three months are over, the three menstrual cycles, she'll be free. But she's not completely divorced yet. She's still considered a wife. That's why he spends on her. She stays in the house. So in this case, if her husband were to die, she has to mourn for him. She has to mourn for him. What about a woman who's permanently divorced? Her husband divorced her for the third time, and there's no going back after the third divorce. Does she have to mourn for her husband, her ex-husband in this case? No. No, because he got rid of her. Why is she going to mourn for him? He's the one who separated from her, and the woman mourns because her husband was taken away from her. When he dies, she feels sadness because her husband has been taken away from her. In this case, the husband didn't want her to be with him. Didn't want her to stay, so he divorced her permanently. She's separated now, divorcee. Why should she mourn for that husband? No. So this is one of the rulings here. Okay, one other thing here is why does a woman have this mourning period? So say for example, the woman, she didn't even consummate the marriage with her husband. They did a contract, and Qadr Allah, he passed away the next day, and she never even had relations with him. Why does she still have to mourn for him? Yes, she has to mourn for him. But why? They never even had relations with each other. What is the reason for her mourning for her husband? They have a marriage contract. So out of respect for that contract, even though they didn't have the actual husband-wife relationship, But the contract itself is very big in the sight of Allah. So out of respect for the contract, this is one of the reasons. The right of the contract, and the right of the husband over her, because he married her. So the right of the husband in this marriage is still there. It's loyalty for her husband. Even though she didn't consummate the marriage, she should have a loyalty towards her husband. She should have the right, she should respect the strength of that contract, which is a powerful contract, and also the right of Allah. They call this the right of Allah because Allah is the one who's in whose name they married one another. So Allah has a right that they don't part. She shows respect for that contract. As for other than the husband, she may only mourn 3 days. Anyone other than the husband, she may only mourn 3 days, like her father, her son, her brother, a child. She's only allowed to mourn for 3 days to show her sadness, except for the husband. Okay, so now we come to the issue of what are the things that are prohibited during the mourning period. What are the things that are prohibited? One other issue, and this might be relevant, is that before we go to that issue, is that say that a woman, her husband was away, and she received news that he passed away, say 5 months after he died, she received news. She didn't mourn for him, and she didn't have the mourning period. Does she have to make up for the mourning period that she missed? No. Because the mourning period starts from the moment the husband dies. Whether she knows about it or not, her mourning period elapsed, and there's no making up for the mourning period. Say that 2 months after the husband passed away, she received news that her husband had died. So what does she do now? She completes the remaining 2 months and 10 days. The 2 months that she missed, does she have to make it up in the end? No, because it already started without her knowing. Jazakallahu khair. Naam. Okay, so now we come to the words of the Prophet about what is prohibited in the mourning period. And a lot of women, they may not know these issues, so it's good to educate them. So that if this were to happen, and of course every woman or many women will have this experience, she will know what is allowed and not allowed. Number one, if her husband passed away, the Prophet said that the widow should not wear dyed clothing. The dyed clothing. What is being referred to here, as Sheikh explained, is the dye that is beautification. Because you have two types of clothing that are dyed. You have the dye that makes it beautiful and attractive. And what this is referring to is the beautiful type of coloring. But as for the regular dyes, like a black or dark brown or dark blue, these are not meant to attract a woman to other people. They're just meant to make the clothing colored, and maybe if she's working, the dirt doesn't show up on the clothing. If it was just plain white, even a little speck from a fly will show on her clothing. But if she's wearing something that's dyed like black or blue, it won't show the dirt as easily. So what is meant here is not that she cannot wear any colored clothing whatsoever, but what is meant is the coloring that makes the clothing an attraction to the opposite gender. Because what we'll see here is that everything that the Prophet prohibited, he prohibited for the widow in her waiting period, he prohibited them as a general rule, things that are beautifications. Things that the woman does to attract people to propose to her, to make her available for others. So the Prophet what he's teaching in this hadith is that the woman should not make herself attractive or beautify herself for the suitors during this waiting period after the death of her husband. As for the black or other colors, then these are not used for beauty. These are not beautiful colors. They're just used to prevent the dirt from showing on the clothing. Also, the Sheikh said that sometimes you have to look at the culture. In certain cultures, certain colors are more attractive. There might be some cultures that black clothing of silk or some type of fabric is very, very attractive. And so the widow, she should not wear these type of clothing if it's in that culture. In other cultures, the black colored clothing might not be an attraction, but it would really go by the culture. And it also depends on the type of fabric and the sewing of the and the material. And some of the ulama said that she should not wear silk. She can wear any fabric other than silk. And others, they differed about that. And then the Prophet ﷺ said, except a garment made from yarn. So the hadith, the Prophet ﷺ said, let her not wear the dyed fabric except a garment made from yarn. And here the ulama, they explain that sometimes the yarn, the clothing made from yarn, is not really so beautiful where it would attract others. So there was an exception to this. And then the Prophet ﷺ said that the woman in her widow, the widow in her waiting period, should not wear the kuhul. The kuhul, the what they call ithmid, for beautifying the eye. So what happens, there's a type of makeup or ithmid that's taken from, it's actually mined in the mountains, I think they call it antimony, where it's placed under the eyes for beautification. It is mined and crushed and burned. Sometimes it's mixed with lemon juice. So the Prophet ﷺ prohibited this because this type of eye makeup, what does it do? It makes a woman beautiful. It's a type of beautification, yes. However, there's some detail to that, because sometimes it's used as a medicine, right? It's used to cure ailments in the eye. And we shall see in the next hadith that some ulama, the Prophet ﷺ, he told one of the sahabiyat, she can use it at night as a cure, but she shouldn't use it in the daytime, because people might come and they might see that and be attracted to her because of that. It's a type of makeup. But if she needs it for medicine, then he allowed her to wear it at the nighttime. And some of the ulama, they said it's not prohibited as a beautification, but rather it has a fragrance that's attractive. Some of the ulama, they gave that explanation, that the kuhul, it has a very nice fragrance, and that would be prohibited because of its fragrance. Imam Shafi, he has an interesting saying, and he said, if the woman is not extremely fair and beautiful in the face, there is no harm in using kuhul. Imam Shafi'i, he said, if the woman is very fair and beautiful and she uses the kuhul, that's no good. But if she's not so beautiful and so fair in the face, there's no harm, no problem to use the kuhul. However, the jumhur, the majority, say kuhul beautifies the eyes. Even if she's brown, it will still make her beautiful. No. And so she should not use it. Then the Prophet ﷺ, he said, and not touch the perfume. The widow, she should not touch the perfume during her waiting period. Perfume could be made from natural sources like plants, like rayhan and other plants, or it could be artificially made. But anything that has a good fragrance is prohibited. What about mint, rayhan, which is sweet basil? These are types of plants that a person might use. It has a good fragrance. But is it prohibited? Is it used for perfume? Mint or basil, sweet basil? No. So it's not prohibited. And even the ulama, they say that if you go for hajj, the muhrim, the one who's wearing the ihram clothing, he's prohibited to wear perfume. But if he went into a garden and he smelled the sweet basil, it would not harm his ihram. There's no harm in that. And then the Prophet ﷺ, he said, she should not use the perfume except if she came out of the state of menstruation, if she's purified. That is, when during these 4 months, she might have her monthly cycle, which women have, and she might even have it 4 times. So, for this woman, if her menses stop, and she, before taking the ghusl, it's actually recommended for her to use a type of perfume, especially in that that would remove, or that is made from this perfume that the Prophet ﷺ recommended. He said it's derived from certain trees in Yemen. Just like they take rubber or they take glue out of trees, they also take perfume out of certain trees. It's a very special type of natural perfume. So it's allowed for her to use that, because it's not used, she's not using it to attract men to herself. She's using it for a specific purpose, which is to cleanse and remove the effect of the menstruation, so it's allowed for her. But it's not intended to attract others. And finally, in the narration of Abu Dawood, he says that the woman and her, the widow, should not wear the henna. The henna, which is, sometimes they mix the henna, the leaves, with other types of things, even the peel of the pomegranate, because the pomegranate is very rough. So when it is mixed with the henna, it makes the ink, or I'm sorry, not the ink, the coloring stay longer on the skin. So she's not allowed to use that, whether it's on her feet or on her hands or her forehead or anywhere that could be seen. The widow in her mourning period should not wear the henna, and not wear the niqab. This is very interesting. Maybe we'll finish with this point. And she's not allowed to wear the niqab, the widow, in her waiting period. And the niqab is usually worn and tied over the face, and other than niqab is just a scarf which leaves the face open. So the niqab, a lot of times the women would tie jewelry. There would many, the niqabs would actually have 2 jewels hanging down, or sometimes the brim would be made out of gold. And the woman, she would use this as a savings in case she had a great need. She could take this jewel and sell it. And similarly, the burqa is worn over the head all the way down, and usually they would put gold on the sides of the burqa. And so she's prevented from wearing the niqab, but she can only wear the khimar, which is the covering of the head, during her waiting period. Sheikh said, why is she not allowed to wear the niqab, but she's allowed to wear the scarf? They say that this is similar to the woman in ihram. The woman in ihram, she doesn't wear perfume, she doesn't beautify herself, and at the same time she doesn't wear the niqab. She uncovers her face. And also the Sheikh says sometimes the woman in niqab, Allah knows best, is more attractive. In some way, the woman wearing the niqab is more attractive than the woman whose face is uncovered. Sometimes this appears that way, in any case, and Allah knows best. And finally, she should not comb her hair. But what is meant here by combing is that it's a type of beautification, but usually when she combs, she uses oil or henna to comb her hair. She doesn't just comb it without anything in her hair, and that oil or that henna could produce a fragrance, and that would also be prohibited for her, because this is a beautification that is used with the oil. So these are some of the prohibitions during the mourning period of the widow when her husband passed away. And inshallah, next time we'll complete the issue of beautification for this for the widow, inshallah. May Allah reward you, and may Allah accept from all of us. Jazakum Allah khair. Is there any questions?